Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, folks, welcome to Food Talk Live here. Yes, we're back again. Pleasure. We got a fun show coming up. We are going to talk about one thing the entire show today because you could talk about Burgundy forever if you wanted to, but we're not going to talk about it forever. We're going to talk about it for the bulk of this hour. I have with me in the studio Risto Zazovsky, who is the beverage director for Michael White's Altamirea Group, which spans continents now. They've got restaurants in New Jersey, in Manhattan, in D.C. You guys got anything in Vegas?
No.
Not in Vegas yet. Hong Kong, London. I don't know. I'm losing track.
Istanbul.
Istanbul. See, that's what I'm talking about. It's a little mini empire. And Risto oversees. He's the beverage director, which I'm actually going to ask him what that means, because I see his Facebook posts of him taking trains to D.C. and moving around. So we'll get to that. And he's just back from Burgundy. If you remember last week, we had Megan McClure in. She was from Domaine Jussieu in Saint-Denis. So we talked about her, about what they do there, and about the region. But we're really going to bore down because it's fresh on his mind. He's just back from a trip. First, I want to give a shout-out to the American team that won the gold medal at the Bocuse d'Or. That's a huge deal. I think that's been going on for almost 30 years.
It's the 30th anniversary.
30th anniversary. It takes place every other year. Over the last 20 years, I'm sure it was big at the beginning, but it's grown in prominence. It's an international competition with teams from everywhere. Japan, the Netherlands, Peru, you name it. And America's always had a team, although we have zero government support, unlike a lot of those other countries. But that's kind of the way America works, isn't it? Anyway, we're not like big in supporting arts and culinary endeavors and stuff like that.
And if we didn't know, we do now.
If you didn't know, you're going to find out the hard way. But it was a huge deal to Matthew Peters and Harrison Tyrone, I believe, were the two chefs who were at the core of it. It's tough. They took a year off. They're both Per Se alum. I think one was the executive sous chef at Per Se here, and the other was somewhere in that kitchen doing something. But you know, they won the right to do this, which is pretty tough. I know James Kent, my buddy down at Nomad, was one of the competitors years back. It's just tough. You're competing against these teams that have been training for years, that get paid to do it, that is government money. Here, these guys took a year off. Had the help of obviously, Thomas Kettler's directly involved. Danielle Boulud is heavily involved. Trained, and they won. They won the gold medal. So congratulations. That is a big deal in the culinary world because it is a first. America's never won that before. So congratulations to those guys. And what else going on? That's about it. We'll talk about other stuff. Who did Asimov? Not Asimov. Who did they review this week?
I don't know this week. I know last week was Thomas Carter's place.
Yeah. What's his name's place? It was Colicchio's place. Fowler and Wells. No. Fowler and Bowler, whatever it's called. Which is funny because he hasn't reviewed Augustine yet, which I've been to, and it's fantastic. It's McNally's joint. There's a new hotel at the Beekman Hotel. It's in, the base of it's an old cast iron building with like the top 30 floors of brand new construction. But you walk in, it's really beautiful. Fowler and Wells is this gorgeous, looks like a private library setting, big leather chairs, tons of room. Tom Colicchio is there. The night I was around the corner eating at Augustine, I went in to say hi. He was there. He's in the kitchen all the time. Good review for him. 2-star review. But I think that Augustine should get 3 at that place. I think that's McNally's best effort since I can remember, since Mineta. But a little different. Really, really great food. Anyway, Risto Zazovsky, let's talk. Why am I holding headphones to my ear? that was strange. So your first trip, I was in Burgundy years ago. But I've traveled around it. I mean, I've been to Lyon. I've been everywhere around it, but I haven't been back in years. And I remember there was like just like kind of like the left bank of Bordeaux, the highways. Back in those days, we had maps, or we had Michelin Guide Vert. I think it was the green guide was the one that had all the little maps inside it, and that's how you did it. You know, someone was a passenger seat, and you're navigating. And I think there's Route 74 that kind of defines the Côte d'Or. It runs north to south.
Yep, around 74.
Right on 74. Bones the epicenter, is that where you stayed?
No, we actually stayed in Nuit Saint-Georges, which was only 10 minutes away.
Yeah, it's not that huge a region.
No, it's
good. But it's so
quick.
Historic, and it's so storied. And, I mean, in a nutshell, they've been growing grapes there for forever, it seems. The Catholic Church was very involved. Monasteries were very involved in, which is not unusual.
Yeah, we decided that one of the best things the system of church brought us is wine after that trip.
It's the truth. It is the truth. That's a takeaway. Thank you, Catholic Church, for that. With Bordeaux, it's considered really the two greatest wine-growing regions in France. I suppose you could throw in Champagne if you wanted to add a third. But I think the rivalry between Bordeaux and Burgundy has been around forever. And it's two very different, I mean, A, completely different grape varietals, but also kind of different growing cultures. You go to the left bank of Bordeaux and you visit these big estates where there's, you know, the famous Chateau this or Chateau that, and there would be this ginormous towering building surrounded by vineyards that usually there's nothing else growing in those vineyards except vines. The soil looks kind of dead because there's a lot of modern farming practices taking place, but there's not a lot of farmers in the left bank of Bordeaux. I mean, the right bank more so now, mm-hmm. but the left bank tends to be dominated by the big brands.
Yeah.
Whereas Burgundy's still kind of farmers. I mean, there's a lot of passion. It's a victim of its own success. If I'm not mistaken, the only place where vineyard land is more expensive, and not by much, is Champagne. So if you wanted to buy a hectare of land, and I'm not talking about Premier Cru or Grand Cru. If you wanted to buy a hectare of good land in Burgundy today, you'd pay upwards of €1 million, which is insane.
Yeah.
I mean, at that price, that's why you're selling bottles of wine.
It's gotten even more. Like, I just heard Canubi in Barolo, 1 hectare was going for €3 million.
Well, so I guess we're going to be drinking lots of wines from other places moving forward. The good news is that's happening, and there's a lot of great wine coming from everywhere else.
Yeah.
But, so talk to me. First of all, tell me, as a beverage director, you're a sommelier by training.
Yes.
When I met you, you had just gotten done a stint on the floor at John George. You went directly to Michael White after John George?
Mm-hmm. 7 years at John George at the main restaurant, and then, yes, went to Michael White and opened up by Fiore.
As the sum, and then now you're the... So what does the beverage director do? Because you're overseeing everything. Everything.
Yeah, I think you're seeing more beverage directors. Classically, you have the Bernie Sons at John George and the Daniel Jonas's from Dynex. But
right.
Like now you have John Reagan, you have Jeff Porter. You have
John Reagan working for USHG.
Yeah, well, yeah, now he's USHG. Well, no, USHG now.
Whatever it's called, yes.
Yeah. And then you have Jeff Porter.
Well, that's right. He went to Unisport Hospitality. That's right.
Yep.
And they put together, there's a bunch of guys. Chris Strux on the floor. I mean, yep. I know a bunch of those. I mean, they had a hell of a team at Unisport Hospitality.
Yeah, and then you have like Jeff Porter for Bastian B&B, and you have Josh Nadal for all Caramellini. So yeah, it's the next layer. I mean, I think restaurants in general have changed a little bit with openings and structure, and you need, I mean, I at the end of the day feel like I'm more of a focus leader than anything else. I want everyone from the back waiters to the GMs to everyone to succeed, and my job is to make sure everyone is focused, and I want to make sure the beverage part of things, which can be complicated and can get, you know, that makes 30-40% of the revenue in the restaurant business, that it's focused and it's, you know, we don't lose any margins, but we also, you know, we spend our money wisely on top of training and setting up systems and, you know, openings and all that, all the not fun stuff, you know, like the sommelier, you know, you say like, oh, I'd love to be a sommelier. Well, being on the floor is that 5% of glamour, right. And popping bottles open and talking right. To guests, but then there's the moving in the cellar and unloading the boxes and counting the inventory. But yeah, so I oversee 9 restaurants. I focus on the United States. So it is New York, New Jersey, and D.C. Like you said, you do see me on the train back and forth from D.C. And yeah, I feel like I'm one of the executive. I'm one of the executive leaders in all of Alta Maria Group. So like, on top of, you know, I'm going in trying to set goals, teach, give depth, and you know, train people, and make all the wine directors, all the head bartenders for at least my division, all better and stronger, and keep adding. And it's hard, you know, because there's turnover in restaurants like any other. So that's why you see me in DC a lot lately. But I love doing it. Like, I love teaching people new skills and learning their pros, and you know, having them focus on what they're good at and learning their fault, not their like their weaknesses, and then like adding, you know, teaching them. And it's just like any job. If you love doing what you do, there's repetition involved, but repetition is good. And I don't think, you know, if you can understand what grade level everyone's at, whether they're in kindergarten to 12th grade, that's the hardest part, because stepping back sometimes and getting out of the bubble of what you know and how you learned, it's you know.
So for front of the house staff, and I know it's become so, I mean, the wine, again, I going back in restaurant history, when I first came to the city, I was lucky enough to have on my second job. My first job was the Four Seasons restaurant, where there was no sommelier. Mm-hmm. The head waiters were assumed to be. We had a great wine program at the Four Seasons. Obviously, it's a restaurant that was well known in the wine world. Tom Covey and Margatai were sort of early pioneers of California wineries. We have barrel tasting. Then they get to the Maurice, which is French, and it's the Parker Merdin was half owner. Christian Delouvrier is my chef, and I met this guy on the floor that wore a Testaverne around his neck, this little guy that had, like, zero personality but knew everything in the world about wine, named Roger Daghorn.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think there were three other sommeliers working in New York at the time, and that was true through the 80s, through most of the 90s.
Yeah.
This idea that one could be a sommelier became a modern thing, and now my question for you is this. Now that that's becoming more common, waitstaff are also just becoming smarter and more educated, as are the customers.
That's the one. It's the customers. And it can be overwhelming, because the skill that I think is the most – the skill that you need to identify or train right away is, how do you find what the guest is looking for and what he or she is not looking for, mm-hmm. and then guide. Of course, you need to have in your back pocket your favorite things and feel confident and feel like you're going to take care of them because they're in your house. But you need to listen, because some tables need more attention than others. Some, you know, some are excited. Some are there because they have to be there. And – you know, it's like a show every night. It's definitely a show every night.
It's funny, because it's hard for me to wonder what it's like to experience restaurants outside of my world. I mean, all of us, our reality is based on our experience in our lives. So I go to a restaurant, first thing I want to see is the menu. I don't want to look at the wine list first, because I want to see what the food is. Yeah. That's going to drive my wine decision. So the wine list sits to my left or somewhere else. Order the food, then think about the wine.
Yeah, but now we have more things. You have social media, right? So you saw I knew the whole Booze d'Or thing, because it was all over, you know? You see reviews. You see Travel Advisor. You you expect they're going to already pull out that ribbon of something with a letter on it before you sit down. I was talking to somebody, one of my friends, like, I've lost the magic of when I go out to dinner, because everyone's already painted the whole picture for me. So the romance. So everybody just knows, for both pros and cons here. It's not good or bad, I'm saying here. But yeah, you're going in, like you said, you want to see the menu first. Me, I might like, you know, not me, but like say I'm speaking to somebody else. I read a review. I want to have those three dishes, you know, like, so everybody's going in. It's all about listening. It really is listening, because you will save yourself so much time. Give the guests what they want, on top of them being on their phones, on top of them, you know, whatever it is. Like, it's just, you know, and it's all experience. And if people can just, I mean, honestly, it's listening. It really is.
So I'm sure the answer to the question is yes, but you do weekly tastings with the front of the house? Because you're moving from restaurant to restaurant to restaurant.
I don't. I'm very, knock on wood, with the exception of D.C. now, so I'm not perfect. Like, we've had the wine directors and the head bartenders at all the restaurants have been there for a little while, and I delegate. I want to give them it's their programs. Like, if somebody new comes in, I know how to get somebody trained and up to speed, and if I have to cover the floor, I can jump in and work a night at Vaucluse, or work a night at Ifiori, or work a night at Austria Marini, and you know, but because the systems are there. It's like any good sommelier should just know the table numbers, take a peek at the wine list, get, you know, get familiar with it. What's the, you know, what's the menu, and then jump in, you know? And, but no, the, I mean, we do, depending on the restaurant. So yes, we'll do line. I mean, it's all about timing too. You know, we're in New York City. Restaurants don't close, you know? I hear this. Can we close on Saturday lunch because we want to do like staff education? Do you know how much that seat costs?
Right, the revenue you get from brunch or whatever your lunch business.
It's like this tug of war all the time. So it's, again, it's all systems, and you know, depending on where my guys are at. Like, you know, I just did reviews for the end of the year with my whole all the senior staff, and one of the head bartenders like, can we just change it like this? Do I have to do it that way? I go, no. If you can fit in a proper 60-minute class, 30-minute class, do it. If you can't, then yes, take up the 5 minutes at lineup, but be organized. Mm. Pop something open, you know, bring it back again. You know, it's like, it's just, but again, it's repetition. And, you know, one of the things, you know, it's like, well, these guys have been here for a while, but then you have new staff coming in and they feel like, whoa, I'm like in second grade. These guys are in 10th grade here. And it's all about making them feel confident. Mm. And eventually, you know, if you give someone confidence and feel like, wow, they are really nurturing me, that's the motivation. Is it hard to be self-motivated? Yes. Is that, you know, is the common sense thing hard? Yes. But if you can find someone that's self-motivated and has common sense and you give them some building blocks, but that's the hard part, you know, hiring. There's just, it's the restaurant. I mean, it's, again, cool. I'm just talking about the restaurant business because I've been in it since I was 12 years old.
Right.
So like you said, like you've met me when I was a sommelier, but like I worked at my dad's diner peeling potatoes at 12 years old and clearing ashtrays with bus tubs back in 92. So like, it's the common sense. And yeah, I mean, I go into an interview now, like, you know, it's obviously layered. We're a big company. So the GM, obviously the wine director has to hire and meet. And at the end of the day, I mean, one of my jokes is like, well, it's nice to meet you. I might be working for you one day, because all these kids are coming out super motivated, super smart. And it's humbling in a way.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I was on a trip to Bordeaux a while back, and Patrick Capiello had a bunch of young Soms with him, and from New York was Erin Healy. I don't know if you know her. She's at John George now.
Yeah.
Tall, thin. I mean, girl's 25 or 26.
No, it's accelerated.
It's crazy.
I mean,
she was 21. She already had her Soms certification.
I mean,
at
I
the drinking age.
Yeah, but I was head sommelier at John. Not head sommelier. I was sommelier at John George at 23. I was head sommelier at 25. I mean, it's accelerated. It's a cutthroat business, and it's exhausting. And if you're organized and you're disciplined and you take care of your body and you don't abuse yourself, that's you know, that's why you see the people, you know, who are still in it. Like, but you know, back to the whole sommelier thing that you mentioned like 20 years ago. I mean, we have people like Larry Stone and Daniel Janis.
Right.
And
I remember Daniel when they opened Montrachet, man, on the floor.
I mean, that's where it all
lay in the kitchen. It was crazy. Yeah. All that talent.
So, you know, with Drew, like having this vision and this focus. So yeah, we have a lot to thank, you know. I mean, obviously there's a lot more people, but I'm just
And the wine world's come so far too. It's just the wine making has gotten in a way so much better. Regions that I'm thinking like how in love with Loire Valley mm-hmm. I am the last couple of years. I mean, thank Pascaline, thank you.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can't drink enough Chenin Blanc. I can't get enough Cab Franc. I just picked up a case of Pepierre's Muscadet from Chambers Street. This guy, how he coaxes that richness out of Muscadet is beyond me, but it's this, you know, so I mean, I could live there now, and that was a region that, I mean, you go back 20 years, and it was just overcropped, chaptalized shit coming out of Anjou and most everywhere. I mean, it just wasn't a region.
But there's the demand for it, and with the demand comes people wanting to know what they drink. On top of drinking food, look at the food we're eating now, and organic, and the, you know, the cheese we're eating here, and which I smuggled over. But wait, I didn't say that out loud. I don't want to lose my global entry. Talk about the wine we're drinking.
Let's talk about this, because you're just back from Burgundy. So most of Michael White's restaurants have been Italian up to now. That was kind of his claim to fame.
Yeah, until Vaucluse.
Until Vaucluse, which is obviously by the name. You're looking at France. So most of your list that you were overseeing were kind of driven heavily from the Italian continent?
No, I mean Marea, I Fiori, Ristorante Marini, with the exception of Osteria Marini here in New York. I mean, every other restaurant is Italian focused, but we do have a decent amount of French and American wines. You know, we want to give the guests what they're looking for, but we also need to have what they're coming in to expect to experience.
So Burgundy, your first trip, amazing. The only grapes we're talking about today are going to be Pinot Noir, is the red grape varietal, the white grape varietal, Chardonnay.
Actually, I brought a wild card, too. You told me to bring. You told me to bring like fun, interesting, affordable.
So. I did. I did. I actually emailed because Restore and I were like.
I was in the cellar yesterday, and I put the bottle of Bone Mar down, and I picked up a bottle of Fixon.
I'm thinking like I don't want if I can't really most of what we're drinking I probably can't afford to buy anyway. But I mean. Yeah, there is almost kind of satellite appellations. There's value. I mean, you could find good Burgundy. When I was at Betard, I talked to Drew's people. You know, they try to keep the list of as many bottles under $100 that they can.
Yeah.
It's getting harder and harder to do it, but it's there.
Yeah. Sure.
So talk about the trip. Talk about, like, day one. Walk me through. All right, because it must have been just a revelation.
Yeah, I mean, this is my joke. I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, and I'm like, it's like the Bills not hitting the playoffs for 17 years. Like, I've been legally able to drink for 16 years, and I haven't been to Burgundy, so I finally made it. So it was an amazing trip. I mean, we studied these books, you know, these vineyards, these big maps, and to be in the vineyard, it was pretty amazing. It's not a big, I mean, again, we were in the Côte d'Or. So we were in the Côte d'Or in Chambly. So it's not big. I mean, you drive 15 minutes, you're pretty much done. And the thing is, it doesn't look big when you're driving. It's kind of like being on a plane because all the slopes are east facing. So when you're driving the road, about most of them are, say you were going, we're going north. They're all pretty much on the left. And it's kind of like this, I would consider like a slip and slide where you have this like slide and this long kind of like, kind of flat land, depending on, again, where you're at. And it doesn't seem that big until you get out of your car and then you step in and you're like, wow, this is actually, now I can see where all the graves come from. Because driving so quickly past it, I'm like, how do they make so much, they don't make that much juice, but like, how do they get this much juice? It's not that big. So it's kind of like a, weird effect. Vision effect. Because, you know, walking through Montrachet at 24 degrees, the vineyard, it was cold, you know. Even being out there for like 10 minutes, it was, walking through it from one end to the other was like a 3-minute walk. So it was not, you know, it's not big, but it's not small. And it kind of gives you a perspective. But that's what it was. It was more giving a perspective. I mean, where do I start? I need to go back. It's like kind of learning a new craft and like, it's like, I guess I use this for poker sometimes. You know, you read a poker book, you think you know, and you learn the basics, and then you learn, like, you read the second level, like more stuff, and you're like, well, I don't know anything.
Yeah, wine's really bad that way. I know, like, I thought I was beginning to, like, get my head around Cab Franc as a grape. Pascaline did a little private lunch tasting at Racine a couple of years ago in the summer, and I drove up from Cape May and back just for that. I'm not going to miss that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pasca. Drove up, and, like, there were 20 wines that we drank, and I was like, everything I thought I knew about Cab Franc from Loire Valley just went out the window. I'm like, oh, shit. It's like peeling it on. You just keep going layer by layer by layer, and maybe not.
I mean, the big revolution day was we had a whole day on Meursault. So we went to four different wineries that were in Meursault. And I think, let's just say, three of those wineries had about two or three of the same vineyard, like same Premier Cru or same single vineyard, which everything is broken up. It's like, that's why it's so confusing. There's like hundreds of different AOCs, AOPs there. So there's borders. And it was just, but it was cool to realize, wait, no, this is what Meursault Charme tastes like. Okay. This is what Meursault Perrier tastes like. Okay. I see Genevrier. Those are the three big ones I'm talking about. But to get that and be like, okay, now I see how that person makes his wine and what his philosophy or her philosophy is, and then being like, okay, the tension has to come from this place. I get it. Okay, this has to be this. But that's easy when you're tasting like 2015 out of barrel because the wines are almost ready to get bottled, so they're really fresh. Then screw it. When they start pulling out like a couple bottles of blind taste, you're like, I'm just going to try to guess the vintage on this because it's like, it's literally like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a puzzle. It's like I said, I just got started.
And because Burgundy is one of the places, again, Chardonnay is the white grape, and the oak is how it's done, and that these wines are completely age-worthy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you are drinking, I mean, not that, again, you could find, there was, Pascaline had a 38 Chenin Blanc that what's his name brought in the other day to Rouge for her to taste. So Rieslings can go. I mean, but Burgundy is kind of known for that.
Yeah,
that oak is one of the reasons it's done is so that the wines are meant to last, built to last.
Yeah. But I wouldn't say they're using as much oak as you think. I mean, I saw a lot of producers like I think 1/3 was the max on even like Premier Cru, which
a third what new oak?
Yeah. Like they're trying to tone it down a little
well,
bit.
Well, good, because I meant the 90s might have been the heyday of that stylistically globally because of the hegemony of California.
Like, listen, there are some producers too, and there is some Grand Cru vineyards that need that because the wine's just, they want it. It's a preservative on top of it being a flavor and whatnot. Like I drank 92 Montrachet from Lafon.
You had an 83 Chablis Revenant.
Yeah.
I saw that on Facebook somewhere.
I posted it today, yeah.
Huh? I was back from today. I'm like, what the? How was that?
It was, like, perfect.
83, so 33 years old.
Yeah, I'm born in 80, so it's easy to do the math.
Holy shit.
It was pretty perfect.
And just had that acid, that mineral backbone.
Yeah, and it wasn't, like, it wasn't flabby or anything. It was like I said in my description on Instagram, it's like, it had no baby fat. It was like, I don't know. I mean, I usually use characters, but like it had that ballerina kind of like just like beautiful physique and just, you know, is powerful still.
And just in its prime, really.
Yeah.
It wasn't moving anywhere. Anywhere. That's amazing.
You can thank Sulfur too for that too.
So what are we drinking? What is in this glass? Because it is freaking delicious.
All right. So I have three different wines here from three different styles. I mean, we're looking for affordability because these wines now with the supply and demand with the markets. I mean, I went to some wineries. They only make two barrels. And I can consider a barrel in Burgundy 25 cases. So two barrels, four barrels, like 100 cases of wine. And so, yeah, I mean, it's really special and it's priced because of the supply and demand. I don't want to even get into that. But yes, yeah, so I was looking for, you know, and it's in Burgundy can be confusing. So for a novice in Burgundy, I always tell people learn the basic big regions first. So like pick four and four, four whites, four reds, and so like you know, Gevrey Chambertin, Chambon Musigny, Vaughan Romanée, and Neuilly Saint George for red, and this is the big area I'm talking about here. And for white, you know, Meursault. You know, let's say Courton Charlemagne, Meursault, Chassagne, and Pouligny Montrachet. Mm-hmm. Like stick with just the things you've seen before. And then after you kind of get a like 101 on that, then it's all about producers. So whatever producer you like, her style will show in no matter what quality qualitative level you're going to get. So if you like the wine, so this wine, the first one I poured for you, is a straight Bourgogne. So it's the entry level.
Entry level, correct.
It's just, right. Just regional. Okay. Regional. It's got a vintage on it. It's 2013.
Is it a Negociant?
No. It's from Domaine George Mugnarese board, which is like really not easy to get. But this is like entry level. So for me, I love their wines. It's Two Sisters. And this wine is from, they're based in Vaughan Romanée, so you're basically getting a baby Vaughan Romanée. And if you can, again, if you find producers you like, you don't have to go crazy on the bank, start with their entry-level stuff. If you like that style, then maybe down the road, maybe splurge on something, maybe $10, $20, $40 more, because you're like, I really like this guy or this person, and I know that it's going to be a quality bottle, because I know it's going to be like, there's more steroids in it, there's more concentration, there's more oomph.
Mm.
So this is an example of a beautiful, excellent producer, entry level. I mean, if you can find it, again, it's all about supply and demand. So all these wines, no matter where and how much they make, like I went to this one winery where she makes two barrels, four barrels, six barrels of her Premier Cruz, and then she made 30 barrels of her Bourgogne. So again, still 30 barrels. I mean, do the math.
I know.
It's still not that much wine. Because they don't make that much. But it's all the surroundings. It's a mix of all the Premier Crus. Everything gets declassified. And they're allowed to also do some stuff from the outside a little bit, too. So, yeah, having that touch and having that style and being in that cellar, you know, this is basically a baby Vaughan Romanée.
What year?
2013.
So,
I mean, again.
Who's the importer?
This is well, I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay.
There's been some
All right, sorry.
There's been some stuff lately. Like people have been changing hands. But yeah, that's my go-to.
So what would this retail for? What would I buy this for at a restaurant?
I mean, at a restaurant, probably like 70 to 80 bucks.
So entry level.
Yeah. Again, when you go to a restaurant, that's what we try to do. We try to find these wines. Like I try to find a great producer's Bourgogne. And you'll know, like, if you like that, and then I know I'm not going to give you, I mean, can I swear? I'm not going to give you shit. Like, I'm looking for, and then we'll change it. And that's this in a nutshell. The other two wines I brought, which we have to taste, because,
okay.
You know. So the next wine is, again, another 2013 young, fresher style wine. And from this is from the region of Fixin, which no one's ever really heard of before.
Fixin.
Yeah, Fixin.
Right, that's how I pronounce it.
Fixin, yeah. And this region is right next to Gevrey-Chambertin, just north. And people know Gevrey-Chambertin, they think that's where it starts. And yes, if you do your 101, like I explained to you, and your you know, your ABCs, but Fixin is right next door. It's right north to it, and it does have kind of, again, baby styles of that. And again, this is, again, probably on the wine list for about $100, retail about $40 to $50, which I know is not cheap, but nothing is right now, and
nor will it ever be.
Nor will it ever be. And when it's young, because people are like, well, this wine's too young, or and but when you get these wines, they're meant to be drunk this way. You know, for the Bourgogne and like the single village stuff, they'll put less oak on it. It's not meant to be as concentrated. It's meant to be more ready to go.
Yeah, this is. I mean, this has a slightly more expressive nose, a little more fruit on the nose, but. First one was delicious too. It's really that there's sort of acid mineral balance background and kind of I hate to say silky tannins.
Yeah, but it's you had Vendôme Romanée first, which is considered the regal of Burgundy. And it's just the pinnacle of aromatics and like the best smelling Pinot Noir probably in the world. Now you're getting to more power and more concentration, but again, not price tag of Gevrey-Chambertin and those Premier Crus. If anyone's curious of looking at these labels, can I plug myself just for they can see it? I'm at Hristo Z, my first name, last initial, at Instagram. So you can just see the picture of what
and it's spelled H-R-I-S-T-O.
Z.
Z.
Yeah. So, yeah.
We'll put a link on the website as well. David's great at that.
So, yeah, what do you think?
This is delicious. We're going to drink. You know what? I'm going to have some more cheese, and I want to talk. I can't talk and eat at the same time. It's one of the troubles with doing radio.
Yeah.
TV, we can do cutaways to somebody else while I'm chewing, but not on radio. So, quick break here at the bottom of the show to give some credit to the people that helped make this show possible for me and as well as the rest of the station, the other shows that we have. So stay tuned. We'll be back with Hristo in just a couple of minutes. Hey folks, Mike Hellemeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so they're Colavita's living in Rome. Colavita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. Hey, folks. I said I wouldn't do this, but I'm chewing on air. Oh, my God. They're going to fire me.
I mean, I brought some Vacheron Mont d'Or raw over, so it's peaking right now. We can't wait.
I have developed, if you don't know, Tia Keene has been on the show before. Art of the Cheese Plate, great new book she has out. We had her on a couple of months ago. And I don't know when it happened, but I guess, you know, it's a good thing because it's change. But I've always loved cheese. I've always loved cheese. In fact, I'm the kind of person that after a meal would prefer to eat cheese than dessert 99% of the time. But, you know, I never really bought a lot of it. And then I guess because of my shopping habits, you know, we're all kind of creatures of habit. I have a bicycle. That's how I get around Manhattan. And I have one of those big walled baskets. I think that's the name of the brand, W-A-L-D. It's what all the guys use, the delivery guys that deliver food to you in New York have it on their bicycles. That was where I got the idea. Because the way I shop, it's like go to the bakery, go to the fishmonger, go to the butcher, go to the wine store, and it was never enough to fit in the small basket. So I got the most ginormous basket that they make for bicycles and mounted it on the back of my bike. But what I'm getting at is I've started like 7 or 8 months ago to just hit like a cheese store. While I'm at Essex Street Market, I'll go to Saxelby. While I'm at Citarella buying meat, maybe I'll hit their cheese department. There's that Italian place that I couldn't remember the name of that's in the back of Essex Street. And some of these people know me. And like some of these cheese places, like there is this sort of black market business and cheeses that get smuggled in that aren't supposed to be sold in the United States. And holy mackerel, it's delicious. So I've been eating cheese like almost on a daily basis for the last 6 months. It's just ridiculous. Like now I've become a cheese addict, which is just crazy. Like I end the night every night around after dinner, post cigar, have a big pot of tea sitting there, and I'll just have cheese cut up with some good bread toasted next to it, and it's like such a great thing to eat. I don't know, man. It's like I have become like a cheese freak.
Yeah.
And I get it. I mean, and your wife's been that since, like, when I met her, she was at Cazalula, and she was just, like, on fire. She was on it. All right, so...
You don't need to do the cheese with bread either. We can just eat it like pudding.
That's...
It won't make... I brought it for the radio.
Yeah. Then this way, we don't have to chew the bread part.
A woman I'm really close to used to say, like, eating crackers or bread with cheese is like having sex with a condom.
Word. Won't disagree with any of that. All right, so... What's the next one we're going to taste?
Yeah, so I want to. I brought three reds for again entry levels, off-site appellations from the heart of the Côte d'Or, drinking wines, getting pleasure, and now what I have here is a great producer, one of my favorite producers, Domaine de l'Arlot, with some age on it, 2004, and this is kind of their entry level Neuilly St. George. But what I wanted to express here is that 04 was considered not a great vintage. But if you love the producer, you want to like find something, and you're again a beginner, or you want to start like I want to like cellar some bottles, or I want to have something with some age, or I want to put it away, or I got this little wine fridge, I would invest in off vintages that you know you might see on like a sale somewhere. I mean, again, you don't see that much sale at Burgundy anymore because there's no wine, but there is sometimes. And if you again trust the producer, the same philosophy I had with the Bourgogne or the smaller satellite appellations that the winemakers or that make, you can be really pleased with some wine with a little bit of development. So this is a 2004. So current vintage coming out is 14 right now. So it's 10 years old. They use stems. So
I
like
was going to say completely. Is this bio as well?
No, I don't. No. Back then, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I can look at my notes.
No worries.
I visited.
So there's stems in here as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's whole cluster, and this has become the big phenomenon. I mean,
Cluster mean carbonic.
No. Whole cluster.
Crushed, but with the stem.
Yeah, so it adds that musk, that layer of, I don't say, you know, it adds that
we whether it's... We say vegetal, whatever.
Yeah,
what's coming from the stems? You tell me, because you're in this business.
I mean, tannins, aromatics.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, more of that kind of like savory component to it, but like animal. And it's not, you know, when you de-stem, you start getting a more fresh, pure style. And again, both producers, I mean, there's no right or wrong way. It's all about your house style. But this gives it some longevity. And 04, when it came out, did have a greenness to it. It had the ladybug vintage that they talked about. And the wines were showing, and I'm like, I wasn't crazy about them at all, but I'm like, these wines are too nervous. I'd rather just taste them in a little bit. And out of like 2 years ago, I popped one open and I was like, wow, this wine is awesome right now. It's like, it's not going to peak much more, but in the next couple of years, I want to drink 04s because you can still get the house style and you can drink it. And it's pleasurable because it gives you the secondary aromas of, you know, more dried fruits. And
yeah, this almost has, I asked if it was bio or it almost has a slight little bit of funk to it and dried fruit and not exactly Gary. I mean, just this kind of...
It's all cluster.
That's totally, it's not that clean, pure expression of berry fruit at all. It's mm-hmm. And the color's funny, huh? It's
well, again...
really on the light side.
Whole cluster does dilute the color.
Yeah.
It's, it just dilutes it. It's not as concentrated in color. So...
Mm. But delicious.
Yeah.
Really alive, really fresh, really alive. Just quaffing wine. So you have like none of this left.
At home?
No, yeah, in the restaurants.
Oh, the restaurants, no. This is from my cellar.
This is from home.
This is from me holding on to it. Like, this would have been sold in the restaurants a while ago.
And it had, so it had that life in the bottle. That's a funny thing, right? People don't realize that wines do that, right? So, I mean, this wine started its life as grape juice, probably fermented with its own naturally occurring yeasts, I'm assuming.
Yeah, almost, yeah.
Right, all natural, yeah. that way. Then gets barrel aged for however long in a mix of new oak and old oak. Then gets bottled and sits for a predetermined period of time by the AOCs. Then it's released. And then, like, wines have like a funny life. Like you'd think at that point you'd have a product that isn't changing much, but they do. They, I mean, I've had Bordeaux that shut down for 2 or 3 years and then reopened again. It's like they go through like. Yep. Like kind of a whole nother phase of maturity once that cork's on and once the lead is on. So that's this same wine that you had 4 or 5 years ago. You didn't like it, and now today it's perfect.
Yep, and Pinot Noir is, a big victim of that. It's got the shutdown, the open up, even great vintages or in lesser vintages. But I mean, that's the thing. Since like the last terrible vintage in Burgundy was 84. I mean, since then, obviously you can only do one crop a year, so you learn from that mistake. But then you have technology. You have people now starting to talk to each other. You have, again, all this information out there. And yeah, even when this came out, I'm like, wow, this is probably one of the worst vintages I had in a long time. And then I'm like, and then again, you have this beautiful magic after, 5 years in the bottle because the wine was dormant for a while. Like, it's like they needed to wake up. Like, it was all green and all kind of herbaceous, and the fruit was shut down. And I was like, wow, there's no fruit in this vintage. And out of nowhere, it just woke up afterwards.
There's fruit now. But you're right, like dried fruit, not high-toned berry at all, the other way around. It's also a notoriously difficult play. I mean, at a time, after World War II, like in the 70s into the 80s, France, it might have been the worst time for sort of big agro farming because it was just... Everyone seemed to have gotten into the idea of fertilizer and pesticides and spraying. It was common. It was accepted. Your neighbors did it. It was like smoking. It was like just that's where it was culturally in the wine world. Now the pendulum swung. And then there was this argument, but the weather's so tough in Burgundy because it is wet and it is cold and they do get mold and they get lots of shit because cold and wet's not great. But I've really seen... A lot. So you tell me, you were just there. There's a lot more move now to be restrained on that, to move away from it. I mean, we don't think of.
I heard, again, I don't think we ask the same question everywhere. I mean, I try to ask a similar question so I can get like understanding the one of the basics. I think only one winery, maybe two, said they went organic in 2016 because of the huge loss in crop of the frost. So again, let me give you a little bit of history in the last few vintages. Last year in the
it was a nightmare.
In the early spring, there was a huge frost and it killed. Yeah. I mean, there's some places that made no wine. And for the most part, an average where, a producer will make wine from like a certain circumference area, like the average loss was about 65 to 75%.
Of total production.
Total production.
So instead of doing... XYZ, you're doing 35% of that, and that's it for the year, done.
And that's, and the same thing with 15. 15 was a great year. The wines are really easy to drink. They've got a nice bit of fruit, and they're really just, they're going to be great drinkers, and they're going to get great ratings. But there was, again, a cool, I think if I remember correctly, August got really cold. So while the grapes were like happy and growing and getting big, boom. It got cold, so the wine's kind of like, whoa, let me put my coats
on.
Shut down a little bit. So the wine still ended up great because it has this beautiful fruit, and that the benefit of that chill, of that cool temperature was that the wines have great acidity. But they didn't, when the vine was supposed to make more juice, so again, 15s for some people, they were like down 30% because the grape just didn't produce as much. So again, it's a really... Every year. It's like...
This is a tough region. I mean, it's pretty far up north. I mean, Pinot Noir does well and Chardonnay does well because they're easy ripening grapes. Because, I mean, why does Champagne only grow a couple of grapes? Because nothing else is going to work that far north. And Chablis not that far from there. We were in Champagne last May filming, and my phone was with me, and you know, like every other idiot, you go to Facebook and Instagram all day long when you're doing nothing. And somebody had sent me pictures while we were, so it's May, while we were in Champagne, from a vineyard in Chablis, which is hail, the side, like covered with hail.
Yep.
Beaujolais and vineyards were wiped out. Someone took a video
people,
from like the wind, like they were up on a hill in Beaujolais, and you could just see the storm front and lightning coming down and hail. It was like insanity.
Listen, I've only been in a couple small hail. I mean, I'm from the Northeast here, so I've only seen hail when it comes down. It's for a few seconds, right? And it hits your car window and you're driving. 30 minutes didn't stop.
Yeah.
30 right. minutes.
And think of these vineyards that are exposed, that are already in fruit, the budding's taken. It's like,
I mean, people died, I think. I mean,
yeah, you're losing sections of the branches, you're losing leaves, you're losing everything.
And speaking of, like, this is going to prelude because we're going to Chablis now. So when we were in Chablis, there was, I mean, I would see vineyards and say, yeah, this, like, no fruit was made. They didn't even set fruit. There was nothing, like, they didn't do anything. So hopefully they make fruit next year. I'm like, okay, great. So that's my into Chablis now. So I think still of the famous names you hear, everyone's heard of Chablis. I think Chablis, I mean, it's definitely a big sommelier favorite because it's got great acidity, yeah. Really refreshing. You want something to drink and just refresh your palate and drink more, because the more acidity and the wine a beverage has, the more your mouth salivates, the more you just want to keep drinking. And so Chablis, I still think, has great value. There's only four tiers there. There's only four AOPs. There's Petit Chablis. Mm-hmm. There's Chablis.
That's what I drink. It's the cheapest stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what we have. That's why I have it here. Regular Chablis, Chablis Premier Cru, and Chablis Grand Cru. And the Petit Chablis is not declassified Chablis. And this is one thing I learned. I'm like, I should have known. I think I knew this. But like, it's something that I thought was like interesting to share. It's different areas because it's got the soil is different. So it's not like you're getting a worse wine. It's just that wine's supposed to be a little bit different. So Petit Chablis is actually really drinkable and has still this.
I don't feel so bad about buying a lot of Petit Chablis.
No. We're drinking a lot of Petit Chablis. So I'm not going to. Well. So with Petit Chablis, again, if you find a producer you like and you don't want to break the bank, I mean, you're thinking, I mean, this is not easy to find what I'm pouring you here because I was trying to find examples. It's the only one I had in my cellar. But, I mean, you can get Petit Chablis for like 15 bucks, I think, hopefully, in a wine store. I don't think it's crazy. And there's big producers, there's big negociants that, in some non-negociants that still make great value. So like, you know, we went up to Brocard, and they're the biggest family owned winery still. They make between 1.4 and 2 million bottles a year. It's huge. But to still feel like, you know, these wines have still, the family owns it. Back to rambling here. So Petit Chablis, let's get your reaction on this. I mean, it's got a little age on it. It's about a 5-year-old bottle of wine that's meant to be drunk young.
Mm. It's really, 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 really delicious. And that acidity, like you have this long
Berkshire cream thing.
Yeah, long, long finish. You're salivating afterwards and you're wanting to go right back to the glass again. And the nose, describe this nose, because it's like this minerally wet, chalk, stony kind of. How would you describe this?
So it's grown on chalk. Oh, I brought some soil.
It's like the soil. It's kind of like what I saw in Champagne.
So
where the substrate is just almost pure chalk.
So yeah, this is the soil that I brought to. Like, look at your hands.
It's chalk. It's you can write on the blackboard with this.
Yep. And I mean, this is from one of the better sites. But yeah, the wine is meant to be refreshing. A lot of really like sour. Crab apple going on, but also that kind of like lactic kind of smooth creaminess, but I consider it more like English butter, like English sour cream. And I mean, it's got some age on it, so this actually has a little bit of, I get geeky now, but it has a little bit of tritus on it. It's got a little sweetness to it, which makes the apple feel a little bit more baked. But yeah, I think it's, again, Petit Chablis, if you see it, same thing with kind of the Bourgogne Rouge or the Bourgogne Blanc. Find a producer you like.
Because those are the entry levels. Yeah. If they have that, that's all they're allowed to call it on the label.
You gave me a curriculum, sir. I listened to your curriculum. Yes. You gave me some rules.
Yes. That's, we wanted to go 101 second semester.
Yeah. So, but now, on the flip side, I have a Grand Cru Chablis here, Le Clos. And I still think for Grand Cru Burgundy, and, you know, you see Grand Cru Bordeaux, we're talking about the two Grand Grand regions, you still get really good value, I think. You can drink like Grand Cru. If you're going to celebrate, you can drink Grand Cru. You can buy Grand Cru Chablis at a liquor store for about $60 in a wine, you know, on a wine list for, you know, probably under 150, and depending on the producer. But so this is again a big producer. Everyone's heard of Drouhin, Joseph Drouhin.
Yeah.
This is their Chablis Grand Cru, and I. You know, again, you see these big producers, and you want to be cool, and you want to get like, you know, oh, I don't want, you know, everyone knows that, or I want to find something that no one's ever heard of before. But there's sometimes stick with what works, and I feel like Drouhin's wines, especially in Chablis, their whites. I mean, other than making a fantastic Montrachet and a Clos de Mouche, I think their Chablis are, especially if I have to find value for my wine list, I will go to Drouhin and put some Chablis on the list.
Yeah, it's one of those names.
But you need to know when. Then again, it's intimidating because you see all these wines from this one house. It's like which ones to buy. So
like Jadeau.
Yeah, and again, my advice is Chablis from Drouhin. You can't go wrong.
Completely different.
And you'll find this everywhere. Like this is not not this one, but any Chablis I think from Drouhin. I think is if you're a beginner and you're like, well, I don't know where to start. It's intimidating. You won't go wrong with this. Now the nose is a little more closed because it's Grand Cru and there's a little bit more wood on this, but
yeah, there's more. You're getting the toast on the oak.
Yeah, but I only say there's only 20% on this, maybe 25.
But I think we've become really sensitive. I'm so glad for it. The move away from like that just oak on reds, oak on everything,
and
those typical flavor profiles. I don't want to get into American oak specifically, but you know, even good French oak. It's just you know my head's totally kind of going 180 degrees the other way in the last 15, 20 years.
I think you got to taste, you got to trust the vigneron. I'm talking about Burgundy. Like 2016, as I mentioned, there wasn't a lot of wine. 70% gone, 30% of crop, right? And for the most part, the regimen for some people were like, I'll put, when I have one vineyard, I will, you know, say I have 5 barrels. It'll be 1 new barrel and 4 used barrels, and they'll blend it afterwards. They'll rack it and they'll blend it. But with 16, first of all, probably the vintage wasn't so grand and so concentrated. Like, there's people that didn't get any new oak at all, so they'd rather put their wines in their used oak. So, again, you got to trust the vigneron because if they're going to use a little bit more wood or a little less wood, it's probably because the wine needs it or the vintage needs it
right.
or the concentration of the, you know.
They know the year, they know the grape, they know their cellar.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we're eating cheese again.
It's got, yeah, I'm not going
to. This has so much more weight. I mean, this is just so much bigger in the mouth. It's just so much fatter, so much rounder, so much more spherical.
Yeah.
And so what would this be retail, 60?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe 70. I can look it up.
Mm-hmm. So you're there for a week and a half.
No, I'm there for 5 days.
5 days, man. You were busy.
Only 3 full days.
Do you know Victoria James?
Yeah, she was there too.
She's right with her Lyle.
Yeah,
Railsback.
Yeah, I ran into Lyle. There was like
he worked for Kermit Lynch.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yep, and there was apparently 4 New York trips, all separate there.
Yeah, I kept getting both of all of you were on Facebook and Instagram with me, and I'm like. You know, she was having so much fun.
Yeah.
I knew she was in Burgundy. And then I guess in a couple of weeks, everybody's going to be in Loire for those big tastings they do there if you're a Loire person.
Yeah. I mean, I won't be because I, you know.
You just had your trip and it was
Yeah,
Burgundy.
I'm done for a while, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, Pasca and a lot of people I know. I think Jean-Luc's going. Lots and lots of people. So was there, I mean, there must have been a few, like a takeaway moment when you were there and it was like this aha thing. So you're in Burgundy, you're in a cellar, you're tasting. What were some of like the highlight things for you?
I was at Ghislain Barthaud, and I've always liked those wines. I didn't know. Again, it's kind of like I like those wines, but now I really like know why I like those wines.
So,
that was the aha.
Right. What was it, now? Why?
She doesn't have any. She's in Chambon Musigny, which is the most probably feminine, pretty of all the Côte de Nuit. It's a lot of limestone in the soils, and really just beautiful wines. Beautiful Pinot Noir. Musigny is the Grand Cru there. It's considered the most pretty Pinot Noir in the world. But she doesn't have any Grand Crus. But she has 9 Premier Crus. And to try 9, I think we tried 7. She only made 8 that year. She didn't make one year. She didn't make all 9, but she had 8. We tried 7 of them. To try the progression and being like, why these wines are still so different, and they're right, like,
next to each other.
Honestly, next to each other.
Which is, because this was their, like, the argument when there was an argument when people were arguing about terroir, the reference point any Somme would use was Burgundy.
Yeah.
No place. So, literally parcel next to parcel next to parcel. I mean, I had this happen in Alsace, too, where I'm tasting Riesling with, I forget who the producer was, Schlumbacher or somebody. And we were standing. We actually went in the car. We stood next to these four slopes, four different Grand Crus. It was the same. I mean, it was like football fields. That one was, it was like a big parking lot, basically. And they all had the same exposure. Slightly different subsoils, I would guess, because it's kind of volcanic, and that's how that works. But then we went back to the cellar and tasted those four wines. They were completely different wines, like completely different. And like now, you wouldn't even think.
I was trying to figure out how to explain earlier. Now I can explain. It's like bricks on a house. It's literally like bricks on a house, because there is differences. Like, that place is not the same place as this. There is a little bit of a different exposure. You start getting a little bit of a slope. Okay, I can see what this means. Oh wow, the drainage is a little bit different here. But I'm a visual learner, and it was just like seeing it. And I mean, I have to go back in the summertime, because being so cold, it was like, okay, I can see this. And tasting was great, because the wines were already pretty much ready out of barrel, and just to taste the uniformity of everyone's wines being at the same place and that. But I mean, what else did I get out of it? I mean, obviously, wine always tastes better where it's from. Everyone's always told me that.
Yeah, it's true. That's a weird sort of sad truth.
And to not have any Primox wine in Burgundy was great.
Yeah.
And I think it is a travel thing. That's what I got out of it. I think it really is a travel thing. I think it's a... another thing I learned was Sansouf, with no sulfur. I mean, because we had a couple there, and I'm like, I would never...
Reds or whites?
Whites. I would never move this wine. Like... Because, you know, just a shock of jump, like getting off of your suitcase, you know, spinning down the luggage rail, and you know, being thrown on the plane. Like, this wine is like a delicate piece of, you know. I mean, I'm using cheese, but it really is like it's like a fresh piece of cheese. Like,
so someone's doing Sansouf in Burgundy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because I know there's been like a real, again, we've talked about this before. There's been a real push towards. I mean, you know, think of DRC as being. Anything, but it's bio. That has been La Flave has been for a long time.
A lot
time.
Of people are bio.
Yeah, the list is way bigger than I thought.
Yeah,
And there's been and the trend is converting to go that way to keep the soil life there to keep it what it you know to be better stewards.
And they're trying really hard because, like, again, they make. Yeah, like saying that these are like bricks on a house and they're right next to each other. There's some vineyards that are bio and there's some aren't. Now, granted, maybe it's because they need to wait longer, but there's probably some aspects where there's some stubborn areas where it gets too cold and they need to use things, or it's not windy enough, or vice versa. So it's just, I don't know. I explained my sommelier, the wine director, one of our wine directors asked me, like, well, compare it to like Piedmont. I'm like, Piedmont reminded me kind of like a water park where you have all these different like slopes and it goes in all different directions. And it's just like, and then I felt like I think I said this earlier, like Burgundy's like a straight down slide, like a slip and slide you put in your yard, and you have a little bit of a slope, and you know you're just going to go all the way to the end. And I don't know. Like I said, I probably am talking, and you guys have been, people that are listening probably been there plenty of times. Like, what this guy talk about? I got to go back. That's my thing. I got to go back.
Where else do you drink? I'm curious, because when, again, my son Sean, who was supposed to join us tonight for dinner, big fan of yours, and drinks a lot more Pinot Noir than I do. I don't know why. Like, it's just why he has no money in the bank. Sorry about that, Sean. But he could have worse habits. Pinot Noir from elsewhere. It's a funny grape. Again, we talked about that. It's kind of a quick ripening grape.
Yeah.
Where are you drinking Pinots from outside of Burgundy that you're stoked about? Domestically. Willamette?
Yeah. Oregon, for sure. I think Oregon... Oregon has that kind of like tension that you're getting. It's not the same, obviously.
More fruit to me.
I think everything's more fruit.
On this side of the Atlantic.
I mean, I just think also old vines. Like, some of these vines that are considered not old vines are still like 30 years old.
Right.
Like, we didn't have, we planted, you know. I think some stuff coming out of Argentina. I think the chakra wines that are coming out that Piero's making down there are really fun. He's got a Sansouf, actually. That was actually a pretty. I think it was like it's.
Did he send up here?
Uh huh. I just came. Next time, I couldn't carry this much wine.
We're doing Burgundy. We're not doing Argentina.
I know, but
I think of Argentina. It's so funny because it's like like Argentina, and then the next thing in my head is Malbec, an American oak, and Fruit Bomb, and I hate that shit.
Yeah, but if
there's
you go,
so much other stuff.
I mean,
going
it's
on.
A big country, it's and a big there's country. A lot of high elevation, and there's a lot of there's no phylloxera in those mountains.
That's true. So you're not pre. There's yep. none. Period.
Yep. And I mean, I like Andersonville. I mean, I like all. I mean, I think everyone's making some cool. So, oh, look who's here. Oh boy. Sorry.
We have to end the show. No, yeah. A, it's 5 o'clock. B, that guy. Hold on. Story up. Hold on. I can shit.
He's got the... my son just walked in, so...
All right. And that's it. That's it for Food Talk. Sorry. Bad ending. My engineer's looking at me like, what the hell, dude? You're just blowing the show at the end. Anyway, yeah, Tia and Story over here. We're going to have...
If anyone's at Roberta's or close to Roberta's, you guys can come by the next hour. We have so many... I have plenty of wine open. That's... Yeah.
Yes, we do. All right, let's go. Right. Thank you. See you next week. I've got a great guest or two next week. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening to Food Talk and Heritage Radio. We'll be back in a week.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.